Thank you for joining IAB There. And now your host, Angelina Ng. Over to you, Angelina.
Thank you, John. Today is June 10th. I'm Angelina Ng, your host for today. I am the VP of Measurement and Attribution for the IAB and IAB There. Welcome to IAB There, our daily live stream in which we connect the digital advertising ecosystem. Today, our topic is misperceptions of ad verification during COVID-19 with our guest, Shalin Dhar, CEO of Method Media Intelligence, also known as MNMI. Before we get started, some rules. If you would like to submit questions, please go to Twitter using hashtag IABThere, one word. But before we start, I have a few words. So for the very first time, IAB New Fronts will take place as a virtual event. The event will take off in less than 2 weeks on June 22nd for 5 days of original video and audio content presentation for some of the biggest names in media and entertainment. This year's New Front is about guiding marketers and agencies towards the latest opportunities emerging from the complexity and celebrating the best new experience available in what is an entirely new day. So again, that date is June 22nd. And we're going to show a short video clip.
It's a great opportunity for all of our clients to come together and get to see the showcase of all the great content that's available from our largest digital partners.
We like to learn what the partners are doing in the digital space. We like to understand what's new, how is the content platforms changing and evolving with the rapid fire digital space.
Thank you for staying with us. Now I'm going to introduce you to Shalin Dhar onto the screen. Again, CEO of Method Media Intelligence, also known as MMI. Shalin, are you there?
Yep, I'm here.
Hi, how's it going?
It's going well. How are you?
Good. So thank you for joining us today and have some interesting topics to discuss. But first, before we start, why don't you give us a little background about what Method Media Intelligence is and what do they do and what your role is?
Sure. I'm one of the co-founders of MMI. We started in 2017 as a research-based consultancy around the topic of robotic and automated traffic. And over the last 3.5 years, we've kind of slowly transitioned to being a full product suite for all ad verification and brand safety needs.
Great. And what do you, can you give us a little bit about what are your priorities for the remainder of the year and what are you seeing as well?
Yeah. Our priorities for the remainder of this year are working on some platform deployments. Historically, we've focused on working with marketers directly on kind of a software license basis. And now with the effects of COVID-19 on both budgets and kind of operation shifts within marketers, we've found some very compelling reasons to make it a little bit more accessible. And we're really focused on framing ad verification as a utility, not a luxury. I think if you look at the CPM prices for a lot of verification and brand safety technologies, the CPMs are high enough that it deters some media buyers, many media buyers, from actually implementing it on campaigns. So our goal for this year is just to really stamp that into marketers' minds that ad verification and that type of protection should be a utility, not a luxury.
Right. Now, let's go into COVID-19 and you know, there's been we've had several other verification companies join us on IAB there. Love to get your perspective of what's happening in the marketplace, and as the topic of this IAB there episode is what are some of the misperceptions that are in place right now that you think companies need to know about?
I think there's some kind of collective misunderstandings in the industry around what is affecting the monetization of news right now. A lot of blame has been pointed, I think wrongfully, at brand safety technology companies, as if we control who spends money and where they spend it. But I think the main thing we have to acknowledge is that budgets have dropped, and that is a major contributing factor to major publishers and news sites not receiving as much revenue as they did before. And the actual brand safety technology implementation around things like sensitive current events, like the pandemic and the deaths surrounding it. You know, one of the examples that's come up in a lot of discussions is there's positive coronavirus news and then there's negative coronavirus news. Positive is, you know, some sort of article or blog post around parenting tips for homeschooling during the pandemic and the lockdown. And then there's others that are very explicitly, you know, negative in a sentiment way, you know, about death tolls and the effect on families. So differentiating between the two is important, both from a planning perspective as well as an implementation perspective. And one thing that we always focus on with clients is knowing whether your detection is happening pre-transaction or post, because marketers have a completely different approach to brand safety when they know that they're paying for that impression anyways, versus if they think that, hey, if I block this, that I'm not going to be actually billed for that impression.
So can you explain that a little more? Because I think, you know, you bring up a good point that a lot of other competitors of yours have been under the microscope regarding putting in their own in-house ads in those spots. But what you're saying is that those impressions are still being billed for and being paid by. But it's just right now poor user experience, or what's going on?
I think the user experience effect is debatable. But, you know, our clients, the advertisers that we work with, have unanimously chosen to just monitor brand safety violations or even keyword flags. They're fully aware that, you know, when you detect that after the actual transaction is complete, that you pay for it anyway. So better to monitor where all it's happening and what type of sites than to block it outright. You know, there's a lot of whitelisting enforcement that can be done to avoid the actual, like, brand safety catastrophes. For, you know, automotive companies, it's around car crashes. For alcohol beverage companies, it's around, you know, DUIs and drunken driving accidents, where you really don't want to be next to those things. You know, another thing for alcohol companies is children's sites and kind of family-oriented sites that you don't want to be placed in those environments. So there's only so much, and this is, I think, really important, is there's only so much that brand safety technologies can control in these live auction environments. And I think a lot of thought and preparation can be done to avoid catastrophes just in the planning phase, as well as being cognizant of what type of creatives are you serving? Because it's not necessarily that users flip out and start a boycott just because your normal brand image was placed in, you know, maybe what the marketer perceives as an unsavory context, but that's where the user is. You know, part of programmatic was wanting to follow the user around wherever they were. But then we had this realization in the industry, well, yeah, we want to follow them around, but not here and not here and not here. And I think there's a lot of planning work can help avoid that. And, you know, not just relying on the live detection of brand safety companies.
Now, you know, during this crisis, as well as, you know, what was happening from a social perspective in the last couple of weeks, where, you know, there's tactics in which brand safety plays, but how does this idea of brand suitability fall into brand safety? And you know, what first, what's the difference? And then how should brands and agencies go about it?
So I think there's the common understanding across the industry, and it doesn't apply to every marketer, but kind of the general understanding is that there's explicit brand safety, which includes things like piracy sites, pornography sites, and any sort of like violent content. That's explicitly brand unsafe, where kind of this critical mass of media buyers has decided that there's no campaign where I want to serve next to that type of content. And then there's suitability, which is specific generally to an industry or a specific advertiser. Like I mentioned, the cases with an automotive brand or an alcohol beverages brand, where specific things to their business, you know, catastrophes related to their business are what they want to avoid being next to. I think the most commonly used example is the airline ad next to an article about a plane crash. You know, similar, like, I don't necessarily think that a shampoo company is going to be hurt by placing an ad next to a plane crash. And that's part of the thing that I think is becoming more of a important discussion in the industry is what type of content are you supporting with your ad dollars? And are you really incentivizing news publishers that attract real human attention to write about current events and do good journalism? Because you know, that's what helps monetize the internet is digital ad dollars. So I think all marketers and decision makers and the media buyers need to be aware of that, that you know, their decisions do impact how we monetize the internet. And I think, you know, for most part, it's kind of that snowflake and an avalanche problem that no snowflake in the avalanche ever feels individually responsible. But, you know, when it gets to a high enough number, it does have some serious consequences.
So especially with brand suitability, I mean, two of the main approaches have been around domain targeting or a whitelist and a blacklist, as well as keywords, right? But we're also hearing from various various companies that they're offering up sentiment analysis and applying that to brand safety and suitability. First, kind of, you know, is that something that you guys offer as well? And what are some of the challenges, if you will, or misperceptions around using sentiment as a tool?
Yeah, we are working on it. Our team is working on adding that, but we do have to tread carefully because brand safety and suitability is subjective enough already. Adding sentiment as some sort of real signal is difficult because you're relying on the human input to kind of train the models on what is positive and what is negative. And that is just inherently biased based on whoever's going to be programming it. And I think we've seen this with Facebook in the past where they hired a large team of content curators to go through the content. And there was a very obvious, you know, political leaning that that collective group had. And people were rightfully upset because it, you know, from the outside, it looks like censorship, but the bias of those individuals collectively does actually create that dynamic. So it is possible. We're working on releasing that in future updates, but I definitely think the industry as a whole needs to tread carefully and not assume that, you know, positive and negative sentiment are going to be clear and then consistent across every vendor.
So how are you planning to help educate your buyers on being able to make, you know, sound decisions off of that then? Like, what are there?
We go the route of boring them substantially with as much educational material as possible. So, you know, when these discussions come up, we get into the weeds on how exactly that works. And basically present to them, okay, if you were managing this, what type of group would you put together to actually create that baseline of sentiment? Because it's not right for one person or two people or even four people within any organization to just make those decisions on behalf of everybody else.
And so you had said that most of your customers were brands, or are they also
all of them currently? Yeah,
all of them currently. Okay, so because one of the questions I was going to ask, you know, if you were to approach the agencies, how much collaboration do you actually have with their clients as well, or vice versa?
So the agency's dynamic is interesting because they have to serve a wide array of customers with all different needs. So our product implementation becomes more generalized when putting it in front of an agency because they're not just serving one type of advertiser.
Right.
When we're working with one marketer at a time, we can scope their brand safety guidelines exactly to what's relevant to them and not generally across the industry. I think a relevant example is you could take the United Auto Workers Union. That is a sensitive keyword for every automotive company. That is not a sensitive keyword for anybody else. And so when doing it through the agency, we have to kind of create the generalized guidelines and then industry or advertiser specific guidelines on top of that. And you know, that it's just how it has to work because the agency has to be able to deploy it seamlessly across the board. And then for specific marketers that have thought through this and come up with their own guidelines, we need to be able to implement those as well.
And how often are you seeing either the client or the agency reevaluating their keyword list, their white list, their black list? Is this something that they're doing daily or monthly?
I think it definitely should happen more often. But you know, one of the things we've seen is somebody basically scraped UrbanDictionary.com and put all the kind of raunchy, horrible craziness from that site into the keyword list. And when our team went through and actually, I feel so bad that they had to actually do this, but they went and looked up all these terms and it was literally nowhere else on the internet except for Urban Dictionary. And so we just told them, like, hey, you can remove all these from the keyword list and just blacklist Urban Dictionary because you obviously seem to have a problem with the content there. So I would generally say once a month is decent, but then there's always off cases when there is something kind of current in the news that is very sensitive, that is very tragic, that maybe an advertiser just doesn't want to touch yet. And there's a lot of different points of view on, you know, whether these companies should be taking a stand and supporting that, whether there's actual detriment to the consumer sentiment on that brand based on it. There's conflicting research. I would say once a month is kind of as much as we can ask from the outside.
Now, during the, once COVID started, especially in the early stages, did you see a lot of quick reactions from most of your customers, or were they kind of in the same position at your POV on being a little bit more, you know, careful about how they were blocking?
So all of our advertisers monitor only. So they just collect the data on where all it's appearing and what type of content it's next to. But if they were to block, I think we would have pushed them to do it earlier, because there's no point if you really have that concern, there's no point letting it slip for several days. So we added those keywords very early on just to see and track that uptick in the flags. But for anybody that's blocking or swapping them out, I would hope that they did it immediately or as soon as possible.
So you talked about blocking. What are some of the difference between pre-bid detection and post-bid detection, especially on how it applies to brand suitability, viewability, and IVT, SIVT?
Yeah, I think most people, I don't think it's necessary that 90% of operators in this industry really know this difference, but for the decision makers, it's important to know that a pre-bid environment comes with limitations in how much information you have about that impression, as well as a time constraint on how long you can take to make a decision. And so in an IVT context, you're kind of limited to things like IP address or user agent, and maybe some other characteristics about the browser. But in a post-bid context, and this is what a lot of bot detection companies and verification companies in this industry tout as a differentiator, is that kind of proprietary behavioral analysis to detect automation versus human behavior. And that really only happens post-bid. And so all the marketers that are doing that post-bid detection need to have a clear reconciliation process in place, because I really don't see the point in detecting 2%, 3%, 10% invalid traffic if you're not actually reconciling it and having it removed from your invoices. And so, there's a lot of people, a lot of media buyers and marketers that have this detection in place, but are kind of just continuing to pay for that waste and not actually addressing it and removing it from their invoices. So, in a scenario, you just have more information to work with and more time to make your decision. And given that, it's important to have a reconciliation process in place. Pre-bid can only do so much. And there was a lot of this discussion in the press and different circles about brand safety technology, with the swapping, that every time you saw blue clouds that, that publisher wasn't getting their money. And that's just not true. Because if you're seeing that ad actually get placed, that means the transaction was complete. And that after the auction closed, they detected that there was something wrong with the context. And then they swapped out a default creative instead of the advertiser's actual ad.
So I have two more questions. One is around ad fraud and bad actors. And do you, there's been lots of articles and studies saying how much we've saved in the industry in terms of ad blocking and being able to detect fraud and bad actors. What are you seeing? Are you seeing that, we are catching a lot of that, but there's still a lot more that we're not? Or are we improving? Or what are some of the challenges?
I think the challenges are, we do have a little bit of an echo chamber around ad fraud in the ad tech industry. The majority of the discussion about what the threat is centers around these like mythical cyber criminals and hackers that just literally have nothing better to do than run ads on their fake sites. Our research suggests something different, and a lot of cybersecurity companies and bot detection companies outside of advertising, their research suggests the same, that the majority of automated traffic comes from data centers. It's far easier to deploy, and there's not the same criminal liability as infecting people's computers with malware and then remotely operating them. I think our focus on what the threat of ad fraud is and where robotic traffic comes from and why it's created needs to change. Estimates outside of ad tech all indicate that it's 40% or higher, the amount of robotic traffic that's on the internet. So we can't really look at this like differentiate between incrimination approaches and exoneration approaches. So everybody's interacted with a CAPTCHA at some point. A CAPTCHA is that exoneration approach that we're going to assume you're a robot unless you can do A, B, C and show us that you're a human. Incrimination works in the opposite way, that we're assuming this is a human unless they display signs 1, 2, 3, or 4. And if they're displaying 3 out of those 4 signs, there's a 72% probability that it's robot, and let's flag it for being that. And I think given the proportion of automated traffic on the internet and knowing that it's coming from headless browsers deployed in data centers, we have to switch that approach from being probabilistic to deterministic.
So who do you think owns that responsibility to remove that ad fraud, ad bot traffic from the marketplace? Is it the publisher, the ad exchange, the ad server, the verification companies?
So the only one being financially hurt by it is the advertiser, because they're the ones paying for everything. And they're not getting what they intended with their money. But it does affect everybody else in the supply chain. It is a common trend in ad tech that a report comes out and people are looking at everybody else and not looking in the mirror at what they're doing themselves. And everybody is a victim and nobody really takes responsibility. Ad tech has transparency issues, but it's all the other people that have transparency issues, not us. And I think collectively we just need to take some responsibility around if a critical mass of advertisers at the same time wises up to the transparency issues and the traffic verification issues that. Industry just downsizes. So I think we all need to take more responsibility, because right now the way we're operating, I don't think is stable or sustainable.
So do you think, given the changes that Google had announced, as well as some of the browsers and their positions around privacy by default, that a lot of this would be solved through because of some of the privacy or addressability and accountability restrictions, if you will, or not restrictions, but the logistics around how it's going to look like without the cookie? Do you think that somehow that a lot of that detection would be solved?
I think privacy and bot detection, unfortunately, have conflicting interests. The more privacy every browser has, the less accurate behavioral bot detection is going to be. Certain browsers like Brave prevent any third-party technologies from being able to look at what the user is doing or what type of device they're on and what type of hardware they're running on. We've always kind of maintained a privacy focus because our detection is based on the device. It's not based on the actual user's behavior. But I think with the deprecation of the third-party cookie, there's going to be either an increase in the cost of verification, or there's just going to be a reduction in its efficacy for any technologies that rely on cookies right now. Because, naturally, if you're doing this very complex behavioral analysis on a user, once you make that decision, you do want to cookie them as either a bot or a human, so that you don't have to do that whole analysis and decisioning again and again and again. So for that reason, I just, our kind of outlook on this is that verification companies will have to do far more analysis and store far more information, which is going to increase their costs if they don't have the cookie to rely on.
So we have two more minutes, and I don't see any questions in the queue right now, but quick one question is with some of the, based on the proposals from Privacy Sandbox and the types of data that would be available, do you you talked about how verification companies are probably going to work much harder to kind of evaluate. So without log files or raw log files and kind of being able to see some of the, getting some of the data points that you collect right now and not have that in the future, what do you think is the future of verification companies?
The future of verification companies?
Yeah.
I think it's going to have to switch more to the exoneration approach, where we do have to assume it's a bot unless we see signs that this computer is operated by a human. And it's going to have to be more and more privacy compliant. There's a lot of unnecessary data collection right now on personally identifiable information, and that's just going to have to go away.
Well, I thank you very much for joining me today. It was
thank
great.
You for having me.
I hope to have you again in the future. So I'll talk to you soon. Thank you for those. On tomorrow's IAB There, we're excited to have welcomed JT Betson, from founder and CEO of Hudson MX, and the IAB's CEO, Randall Rothenberg, where they will be discussing the growing need for the industry to start the change equity movement. IAB There is a production of the Interactive Advertising Bureau. Our show today was produced by Connor Healy, Joe Ons, John Ward, and Twafiqa Mahunuddin. I'm Angelina Ang. Thanks for watching. Come back tomorrow, because if it's 2 p.m. Eastern on a weekday, you know it's time to IAB there. Thank you again, everyone. Have a great day.
It's a great opportunity for all of our clients to come together and get to see the showcase of all the great content that's available from our largest digital partners.
We like to learn what the partners are doing in the digital space. We like to understand what's new, how is the content platforms changing and evolving with the rapid fire digital space.